you've got 10 to the 11 galaxies, so that means you've got 4 times 10 to the 22 total stars in the observable universe. And when you take a Hubble ultra deep field picture, you suddenly realize that the word observable becomes quite nebulous. And what you thought was a blank area of space, you find 2,300 galaxies you've never seen before. When you do the Hubble deep field, you know, aim it in one particular point in the sky for 1 million seconds and integrate that picture, and what do you get? A whole lot of stuff you've never seen. So if you build a bigger and bigger telescope and you look further and further out, you're going to see more and more stuff. Ain't no end to it all.
Jindig?
Yeah, go ahead.
KC2WGB. Dick, I believe what you were referring to would be looking at the planet edgewise as far as the terminator is concerned, and then seeing the difference in temperatures on the spectra between the umbra and the preumbra of the dark side.
Assuming it's an Earth-like planet, and assuming it takes a year to make a full orbit, and assuming that it's only in front of that star for 13 hours, when you look 45 hours downrange, one day downrange, as far as the angle it has swept with reference to its star is concerned, very little is happening. You're still looking at exactly the backside of that planet. You're looking at the dark side. You're a fraction of a degree off from looking at the dark side. Therefore, as the planet rotates, let's assume now that it's rotating counterclockwise top view, just like the Earth does from our reference point. Counterclockwise top view. And so therefore, the left-hand side of the planet is rotating toward you. The right-hand side is rotating away from you. The left-hand side of the planet that's rotating toward you has just experienced sunset. Therefore, it's going to be, on average, hotter than the right-hand side. But you're always looking at the backside when you do it within a small number of hours of the time it passed in front of the star. Now, you could look 4 months downrange, where now you're looking at the planet's side view, where the left side is solar lit and the right side is dark. And now you're going to get a different answer. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Frank?
Okay, Dick, thank you. You answered the question. Very good. Back to that.
Was there a person that wants to join us? Start off with your call letters and name. KQRIW, my name is Dick.
Hello, Dick. The name is Gary, George Alperio Yankee, and my call sign is Kilo India, 6 India, Juliet India. I'm in Citrus Heights, California, and I am into astronomy, and I do have a little bit of a thing for you. I loved astronomy. In class, we had to do looking at the different gases through a prism, and it was on top of a, they had to show it on a movie screen, and you had to make a little, had to make a graph of the different colors that the gases were through a prism. And my teacher used it for a teaching tool when I left the school back in the 70s. And it's very nice to be with your net. Not in for any conversation on astronomy. It's not too technical, and I'm glad that you're there. This is Kilo India, 6 India, Juliet India, Gary in Citrus Heights, California, and I do know a person that is a descendant of Johannes Kepler, the one that you were talking about, the Keplerian movement. Back to net.
Sounds like you've got quite a bit of interest in astronomy, Gary. Gary, what size telescope do you own? I'm going to make a guess. It might be an 8-inch Schmidt-Cassegrain. Over to you, Gary.
No, I do not have a telescope right now. I wish I did, but I am into astronomy. I look at all the constellations. We can see Orion real clear around here with Andromeda and the belt. For that, I can see the North Star, and I can see the other planets around here with a nice and clear. But I do not have a telescope, but I do remember it when I was going to school. Back to net.
Are there any telescopes we can look at on the internet, through telescopes on the internet?
I think there are. I don't know where, but I'm believe there are websites where you can look through a telescope. And I wonder if anyone on frequency can give us an answer to that. Give me your call letters right now. KQRIW in the TechNet.
You might try World Telescope, Dick.
Give us a couple of words in that one, John. Have you used it, and what did you see?
Yes, I have, Dick. It's quite replete. There's a lot of information there and a lot of star fields, which you can zoom in on and stuff. Whether they're actual, I know they're not real time, but they are photographs, I believe, that have been incorporated in this very nice program and very easy to use.
Sounds good. Now, what I mailed Glenn, John, Wesley, I guess it was just those three guys, maybe it was the fourth guy, I mailed them this email address, this URL, where you can look at these 12 individual, 7-minute long lectures, approximately, by Richard Feynman.
Thank you, marvelous.
Yeah, he does a rather nice explanation. I mean, one of the really nice things he did, for instance, is that the numbers are really confusing to most people. You can talk about a molecule or an atom having approximately 1 angstrom in diameter, 10 to the minus 10 meters. And you can talk about the size of the Earth and whatever, and most of us can't relate to that. His beautiful example was that if you take a molecule and blow it up to be the size of an apple, and you expand everything at the same size, then the apple would be the size of the Earth, or maybe twice the size of the Earth. That gives you a little bit of a feeling for how small molecules and atoms are. The ratio of an apple to the Earth is roughly the ratio of an apple to a molecule.
Question.
Yeah, go ahead, Wesley.
Yeah, I do very much appreciate you did to me a very beautiful gift, but based on that concept of the Nobel Prize winner, professor, and beautiful mind, I just completed this set of the emails, and when you're ready, I would love to ask you the question.
And as of my beliefs before last TechNet, I used to think that with the double slit experiment, photons would show a pattern, but that they would behave like a wave. But I used to think that individual electrons would behave as a particle. And by way of those MIT 802 lectures, and I think it's about 35 of them, there they made it fairly clear that the electron, when it's going through a double slit, also behaves like a wave. Go ahead with your question, Wesley. We're all slowly struggling with this jazz and try to understand it. N2XJN, K2RIW.
N2XJN. Well, I was watching that video lecture that I had sent you from the professor from MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and then after watching the last set of that beautiful man, I was trying to imagine things. Okay, now the professor from MIT explained precisely the standing wave properties. Most of us think about the standing wave as something that is loss. It's losing. But he pictured that standing wave as something that is normal. It is there. So if we would picture the Tacoma Bridge, and we say that the Tacoma Bridge was made from very much flexible material, and we have a steady wind that is actually causing the up and down movement. That's what the property of the standing wave ratio is. It is standing. Then we would have something that would stand. Now, we have the power amplifiers, and when we have a standing wave ratio, we can reach enormous amount of power in a very short period of time, and we damage the tubes. Let me jump. So the traditional understanding of standing wave ratio is that we have a mismatched transmission line, which is something that we have to overcome. At the same time, we have a distribution that depends on wavelength of the applied signal, hence of its frequency. Then, we think further. What do we have there? The acceleration, which is the word, and it is produced by cavitation of the particles through sorting the electron to the proton as the electron oscillates from its highest to lowest orbit and subsequent energy state. As the negative particles build up, they need to have an earthly ground, something that is the safety valve. Let me check.
Now, before we go on, I think we ought to stop right here, because I think your basic question, your first question, is a standing wave lossy or non-lossy? And the answer is yes to both. If I set up an intentional cavity resonator, by definition, it resonates because the transmission line inside of that cavity is some multiple, an exact integer, of a wavelength long. The signal comes down that transmission line, hits the end, reflects back. Most likely at the end is a short circuit. It doesn't have to be. It reverses in phase and so on. The signal bounces back and forth. The standing wave does not have to be lossy. If I'm careful enough, I can build a cavity resonator where the Q is 10,000. That means the signal bounces back 10,000 times before it's dissipated 37%. In the case of a quartz crystal resonator, a precise one made, a precise crystal resonator made in a vacuum environment can have a Q that's close to 1 million. The signal, the resonating signal in that quartz crystal is bouncing back and forth 1 million times before it comes down to 37% of its amplitude. So standing wave doesn't have to be lost. Now, if I had a pure 50 ohm signal generator, and I send a signal down a piece of low-loss transmission line with a short circuit at the end, and the signal bounces back, without a doubt, I've got a standing wave. But of the signal that comes back, and it re-hits the amplifier, it's called a signal generator, and if the signal generator is a pure 50-ohm source signal generator, all of that reflected signal is absorbed and turned into heat. Now, turned into heat is not bad. Energy is something that can be converted in form, but you can't lose it. So the fact that you've converted it to heat means that as far as usefulness to a ham radio operator is concerned, it is fairly useless, but it's just another form of energy. So I can make a standing wave ratio, which is extremely lossy, when I start out with a pure 50-ohm signal generator. If I'm using a pure current generator, like a tetrode tube, I can have that standing wave bouncing back and forth in there very losslessly. So there's a lot of misinterpretation of standing wave ratio. Every transmission line, whether it be free space air, whether it be a piece of coax cable, the magic of a transmission line that's not very made very clear in any of the books that I've read is that it does not care if the signal is flowing from east to west or flowing from west to east. It treats them both the same. The transmission line itself does not mix the signals together. It treats them thoroughly independently. When I put my probe on my slotted line in there, my probe is a non-directional detector. It sees the forward-going signal from east to west. It sees the reverse-going signal from west to east. And my probe on my slotted line detector picks up the two signals, mixes them together, and I see a higher voltage on that probe in that location. I move it to another location, I see a lower voltage, and the ratio of those voltages, I call it standing wave ratio, but the transmission line did not do that. You did that by the length of the line, where how far downrange you created the short circuit. That determined where your probe will see the peaks and the valleys. I could put a directional coupling detector into that slotted line and move it along the slotted line. I would continuously see only the forward-going signal, and there would be no variation. I take that detector, reverse it 180 degrees, and move it along that line, and now I'll see the reverse-going signal, with no variation. So you've got to be careful now as to how we interpret a standing wave. Is it lossy or is it non-lossy? And the answer is yes. It depends on how you're using it and how you're detecting it and what's the environment.
And I would like to go to the point, if you let me. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I didn't want you to leave that subject before we cleared it up, because each of your questions usually has three questions mixed together, because you're afraid we don't have enough time and you want to squeeze them all in. And that creates a little bit of confusion. Over to you, Wesley.
Okay. So, we're seeing the standing wave pattern. We have something like electron bounce phenomena. Now, it is you who, I hope, gonna correct me, but we're talking about something that is trapped. The Tacoma Bridge was trapped between one coast and the second coast of the river. Okay, so we have something, and we could create a standing wave ratio. So, then, in August 5th of 1990, Nikola Tesla patented electrical transformer or inductive device, which actually has a lot to do with standing wave ratio. Then, there is another patent that I believe I sent you that with the email, which is suppression of the transformer capacitive current. And that one is from 1993, September 14. Now, if you look at how that is constructed, then you see a lot of common with that what I'm talking about. But let me go further because others don't have the copy of it. Now, that's what is blame of a phenomenon if it ever exists, or fiction if ever exists, of untapped energy is standing wave ratio. At least people think this way. And another interesting point, in most, if not all of these devices, the spark gap is employed. And guess what? The property called spin lies within air particles. They contain magnets. And it's by the education of proton nuclear magnetic resonance by Royal, I don't remember exactly, but I have sent you the link to that, Academy of whatever, it is shown that the H1, or 1H, which is hydrogen 1, which is in the air, and carbon 13, that is in the air, both of them, they contain field that they contain the properties that react like nuclear magnets. And now we're talking about proton nuclear magnetic resonance. And I'm going to tell you why did I contain that with the first part of the question. Now, actually, these particles, H1, which is would be hydrogen 1, has its own micromagnet. It is completely reactive with straight magnetic field, not electromagnetic field only, but magnetic field. Then, when it's placed in external magnetic field, this nuclear magnet reacts one of two ways, with or against magnetic field. This means that they have slightly different energy levels, and the electromagnetic or magnetic field or radiation, which has energy corresponding to the gap between that particle and surrounding north and south, can flip that from lower to higher energy level. Then, the size of the energy gap determines the frequency of radiation required. And the reason that I came for it is that now we're dealing not only with the magnetic and magnetic field, but we're dealing with magnetic air. And then when we go to nuclear magnetic resonance, then we find that the frequency of ferromagnetic nuclear resonance is 21.5 megahertz, which is the length wave of 13 meters approximately. And then most of these devices, they utilize the copper wire tube running through the center of the coil that produce 1/4 wavelength shift for the length in meters, that would be 3.4 meters. And there are four phases of 90 degrees of the sine wave to infinity, or very close way. Now guess what? We're dealing with four parts of the sending wave ratio. At the same time, we're dealing with the nuclear magnetic resonance that does have the same concept. And I'm trying to find out why the impedance... I'm looking for the word. Oh, okay. So then when we employ the spark gap, the spark gap produces cavitation to launch electrons of the highest orbit. Timing is everything. So if we find the right time, like it was with the Tacoma Bridge, and then let's say it was found 470 microfarads of capacitance, the inductance would be at that point with given parameters approximately 1.1 of microhenry with the frequency of 21.5 megahertz. And that's the properties that are needed for that resonance. But proton nuclear magnetic resonance was done by chemists using very low temperature, and in this video that I have sent you, they acquired this way. But there are a number of proofs, scientific proofs, that the same could be done with the regular temperature. I'm trying to put all of this together and find what depends from what. I started from the standing wave ratio. I went to the conclusion that air is magnetic. Then I came to the point that it is magnetic because of nuclear particles that have dipoles in it. And then I found that there is a need of something else in order to activate them. Now the spark is that what it does. And I use also the term grounding as a safety valve. So what would happen if we use part of that standing wave, let's say 10%, we utilize 2% of it, and the remaining 8% we will return to the input, so that standing wave will not die as soon, but it will die a little bit later. Back to you, and thanks again.
I think you're saying that once you set up a kind of a resonator that has a known standing wave and a forcing function, and if you can control the rate at which standing wave dissipation takes place, and you can do that with lossy materials, or you could do that by coupling energy into some other place. So yes, you can control the ring down time of a resonator. We can call that Q, we could call it damping function. And so I think I'm going to accept that. When you said that air is magnetic, that I'm not completely familiar with.
I sent you the video link, and this is scientific material for chemists.
Okay, if air is magnetic, give me an example of something that is not magnetic.
Sorry, disconnecting.
It is stated that the hydrogen 1, carbon 13, fluorine 19 and phosphor 31. These are the particles. They contain magnetic dipoles. Hydrogen 1 and carbon 13 are present in the air at the certain conditions. The presence of these conditions is the spark. I have mentioned before about the hammering effect of the spark. Now, the belief is that during that flip of the from the lower to higher energy state, there is a acquiring of the energy from surroundings. As we know, standing wave ratio could be energy to the temperature. How about if it's reverse? How about if we acquiring extra energy? So what I'm trying to say is 10% of the energy of the standing wave ratio is extracted by the safety valve. Now, 8% of that is returned back to the input, causing the standing wave living longer. 2% is simply being consumed by us. In the ideal situation, we're not talking about losses. But we may also gather some energy because of extra interaction. Back to you.
Yeah, I'm not sure I've got anything to add to this. Let's see if anyone else on frequency does. Give me your call letters right now, K2RIW.
Question, Dick.
Go ahead, John.
I'm questioning the usefulness of it. The energy that we start with helps produce the standing wave, so that's accepting it as a loss, let's say. Now we want to take that and couple it back, but we're not going to have an increase in energy. We're still going to have less than what we started with anyway. I don't follow this concept.
The concept was like, I gave the example. We have a 15 years old girl, 15 of them, and they are pushing the car. Now, after a while you need two of them, and after a while you need one finger of one girl just to sustain the motion. So we say that at a certain speed, we need less energy to sustain the motion, that is the losses. So I was trying to say that we might not need over units or unity. What we need, what we may have is just the vibration of standing wave just living longer if there is no extra energy that is coming from elsewhere. Back to you.
A bell and a flywheel are kind of an energy storage device. I can put energy into it, and if it's low enough in the loss, I can get the energy back out at some later time. In the case of pushing an automobile, it is hard to push an automobile at first because of the flattening of the tires. And the tires have been sitting for 24 hours. The bottom of the tire is slightly flattened. And so you think you're pushing the car on level road, but as far as the tire is concerned, at first you're almost pushing it uphill. I know that modern-day tires don't have as much of that, but back in the days when I had rayon tires in my car, for the first mile when I would drive them, they would make a thumping sound until the flat spot disappeared. If I had a very well-lubricated set of bearings on a railroad car, the amount of force required to move the railroad car, there's a certain amount of force required to accelerate it. But once I've accelerated it, it requires less force to keep it rolling because I've only got to overcome friction. So force equals mass times acceleration. Whenever I'm accelerating a massive object, I must apply more force during the acceleration. But after the acceleration happens, the only force required is that force required to overcome the friction. I wonder if you see it that way, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
But Dick, what I think Wesley is saying or implying is that if we were to recapture the heat from the wheels and the rail and feed that back as the impulse to drive the wheels, is that what he's saying?
I'm saying that we could have unknown interaction of the energy, surrounding energy that is there, that would add up to the energy that is already there. And I was relating to the magnetic air. That's not what I think, it's what is proven. Because the hydrogen one does have a magnetic dipole.
Is it the hydrogen that's contained in the living material that gives part of the image of magnetic resonance imaging? Over to you, Wesley.
Yes, you're talking about MRI. I'm talking about NMR. Certain parts of these techniques are very much similar. But in order to activate the hydrogen one, chemists, they use, and it is explained in this material, which is the scientific material for the student, is how do they do it. But at the same time, there are other ways of making this hydrogen one reactive, which is the spark.
Tell me what you think is taking place during a spark, because I've got an explanation as to what happens when I run my high voltage machines and I make a spark in air. Tell me what you think is happening when I make a spark in air. Back to you, Wesley.
And to exchange. Okay. Well, first, what is unproven, but it is something that might have existed, hammering effect. So let's say you have a hammer lying on a shelf, and it weighs 2 pounds. Then, the pressure on the shelf is 2 pounds. But when all of a sudden this hammer slides from the shelf, which is the initial energy to slide the hammer, then the impact to the table from, let's say, 1 foot is, let's say, 10 pounds, or let's say, 20 pounds. So the hammering effect is also taking place with the speeding particles. And plasma is matter. And then, in that plasma, we have existence of hydrogen 1. And we have existence of carbon 13. And to exist.
If need be, I could explain why I believe the air in the room with me right now experiences a spark when I exceed 30,000 volts per centimeter. I'm not sure that that's going to help the discussion we're having right now. John, what do you believe is the next step in this discussion? Over to you, John, K2RIW.
And KC2QIQ. Go ahead, Glenn. You take it.
Yeah, I might take a swag at this one, but I think what's happening here is that we're talking about too many different non-related things. In other words, we're trying to make a relationship between them, but I'm not sure that there really are. I know from, quantum theory that, when we're talking about the spin, like in a quantum model, there's a thing called the spin number of S, and let's say neutrons and protons roll in balance. There's numerical numbers of balance within the molecule. So the atomic value of the spin is zero. Generally, those things they're called ferrous molecules. But I don't think that has anything really to do with magnetism or, when we're talking about, on the large scale, magnetic forces and things of that nature. It's just a property that's used to explain the spin motion of the of an atomic structure. But here again, I think maybe what's happening is because when Wesley's talking about the numbers, like he's talking about, like the odd numbers of proton-neutron balance, okay, is going to determine the spin value. And there again, they can also have fractional values, like five seconds and, one half, depending on that ratio. But here again, I'm not sure that that really has much to do with, you know, this overall discussion, but I could be wrong. Back to you, Dick. K2RW, KC2QIQ.
Just a question when you get a chance, Dick.
Bob, I have sent you also the link to completely explosive, ultra-compact, high-voltage, nanoseconds pulsing generating system based on Wikipedia also, and I have the article, is utilized by the Army to make the very powerful shooting devices. So you could say that we have the energy in within the sending wave, then we think about what to do with it, then we find any kind of safety valve, which might be the spark. The spark makes the particles activation of hydrogen 1 and carbon 13. Then this air becomes very much magnetic and interacts as the air also with surroundings. That's what I'm trying to assume. Then what I'm thinking is, could we somehow take the part of this energy and return it to the beginning, since we have already car in motion, then we need very little amount of energy just to try to sustain the motion. The same story is with the modulated heating burners. At first you have a flame energy deliver, and then you have a very, very tiny modulated flame that is just trying to keep the motion, but the energy of that flame modulated is within 3% of the total energy. That's what we're talking about, the speed. Back to you.
Just for a quick break off to one subject, Glenn, quite often you say you're going to take a swag. I think you mean you're going to take a swipe or a wag. Maybe you're intentionally combining the two. Wag is wild-ass guess. Swipe, we know what that is. So is a swag a mixture of swipe and wag? Now back to you, Glenn.
You caught on to that one, huh? It's a little bit of my humor there, Dick. Back to you, K2RWQQQ.
Okay, so it's intentional. Wow. Is that a Marchione invented word?
Yes, it is. And the funny thing is, you should see what I can do in German when you just keep on adding all the words and make them longer and longer. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, after you answer to John, I have a question about a coil wrapped over the capacitor, and I have sent you the explanation for that also.
Now, when it comes to impulse generators that work by collapsing a magnetic field or by piezoelectric effect, they have been around for some time, used on various kinds of particle weapons and non-particle weapons. The so-called high-power microwave weapons use things like that. I know you had a question, John, so go right ahead. KC2WGB, K2LIW.
Well, we used to dip in for a swag in the steel furnaces and the Bessemer furnaces, so maybe that's what he meant. But my question is this. I'd like to keep, if it's possible, to reduce it to your simple mechanical model of the railroad wheel. If we had that on the track and we got it to move, how would Wesley couple energy back to this to keep it going? What device would he use or what system? That might be something we could investigate. It's pretty simple.
And by the way, one of those Richard Feynman lectures talked about how do railroad reels work, and they're very different than the average person knows. That flange almost never rubs on the rail. And the wheels themselves are tapered in a cone-shaped object when you look at them edge view. And that's how the railroad car stays in the middle of the track, so to speak. Very crafty, and can go around the corner even though it doesn't have a differential on those wheels. That was something I didn't know. Didn't realize that. Never asked that question. But as I see it, when a railroad car is rolling, it's going to take a significant amount of force to accelerate it. Every mass takes force to accelerate, F equals MA. But after it's been accelerated, you've got it up to the velocity you like, and now you've got the losses taking place. And most of those losses are either wind resistance or bearing losses, or there's also a rolling loss between the wheel and the track. It's not 100% constitution, you know, the coefficient of restitution between a rolling steel wheel and a steel rail. Let me drop. That coefficient of restitution is very good, but if the tracks were on a concrete structure instead of on wooden rails, the wooden rails on the gravel that there are is a deflecting medium. And you take a piece of wood and you deflect it, you create some heat, some friction involved. So the rolling friction of the railroad car has a rolling friction between steel and steel, rolling friction between rail and the wooden railroad ties, wind resistance and bearing resistance. Most of those losses are creating heat, and if you could capture every bit of that heat by some magic and put it into the right kind of a thermal engine that converts a difference in temperature back into mechanical energy, that would be good. But those machines that convert differences in temperature back to mechanical energy, so-called Carnot cycle, I'm a little worried about that one, because I think most Carnot cycles don't have more than about 30 or 40% efficiency for a bunch of complicated reasons. But maybe, Glenn, I've heard you mention Carnot cycles in the past and what kind of efficiencies that are available. KQRW, you got it, Glenn.
Dick, I might be out of range right now. I'm on the HT. Am I making the repeater?
You're making it very well. Please continue.
Yes, excuse me for a minute, because I'm actually outside, and I'm going, like, inside and outside, and I might have missed a little, the last few sentences there. If you can repeat them for me, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, let me boil it down to the bottom line. I've heard you discuss the Carnot cycle a few times in the past. If I've got thermal energy, and I've got a source of heat, and I've got a sink for the heat, and I'm now, by way of a Carnot cycle, trying to convert the differences in temperature, the thermal energy, I'm trying to convert it back into mechanical energy. I think that's usually done by a Carnot cycle. I'm a little worried that Carnot cycle, in most cases, is not much more than about 30% efficient. And then the next question is going to be, where is that inefficiency? Over to you, Glenn, K2RIW.
Yeah, I'm not an expert in that area, Dick, but I'd have to agree with you that 30% is a wish. You know, that in those devices, that, the amount of efficiency there is really quite poor. You know, how much loss there is, you know, going back from that, and how much can really be recovered is, there's, I mean, tons and tons of reasons why that is, and I wouldn't even know where to start. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
So I think that to answer your question, John, even if you could gather all of those sources of heat, the heat on the rails, the heat on the railroad ties, the heat in the bearings, and pour it back into a mechanical machine that converts the thermal differences back into mechanical energy, I don't think we're going to make it. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
That's exactly my reasoning. So I don't see, even if we could recover 100% of that, I don't think it would work, because that was all put in with the original input of energy, and we can't get more out than we get in, we put into it. So I was just looking for a description and trying to apply what Wesley's talking about to a mechanical structure to see if it's possible. So that's why I wanted your input on that.
Well, what I'm thinking is that we can overcome part of this losses by simply putting the magnetic cushion between the truck and the wagon. This way, at least we don't have a friction involved in it, so less energy is being consumed. With the same token that I was telling about 15 girls, we can actually put initial energy into it. The whole complete idea of imagining, and it was imagining, was that the standing wave ratio deals with 4/4 of wavelength, and the proton nuclear magnetic resonance, NMR, reacts exactly at the same concept. Now, we have also the corresponding magnet, micronuclear magnets. They are slipping based on this tacting, tic-tac. Then, we're talking about conductive air because of the presence of a spark, and we're talking about the speed of electrons hitting from one side of the spark gap to the other side of the spark gap. I have found one interesting phenomenon that with the collection of the radar tubes, some of them glow, gives me a beautiful spark, but at the same time they have some kind of gas in it. And I was trying to light up the bulb by the resonance, it doesn't work. But then I have a few others, they are not compressed, they don't have the vacuum inside, and they react much better because of the access of the air. I have noticed that with one of the tubes there is slightly cracked in it. So then it turns my attention that there is something in the air. I'm sorry, you see, without the imagination, even though that it might sound completely unsmart, not naming it different way, there is a very hard to progress and to achieve.
Casey 2QIQ with a comment here.
Yeah, go ahead.
Wesley, I think what's happening here is that entropy is what really kind of happens, and that's what I think is really why it's so hard to always get back to at least even, you know, 100% efficiency, is because there's just a certain, you know, the law, you know, the second law of thermodynamics, that in every closed system, you're always going to have, you know, a thermal energy loss just due to the fact that whenever you're doing some kind of work or energy is taking place, there's going to be a thermal transfer, even at the molecular level. So even to try to recombine that energy and bring it back again, you'd have another thermal loss going back to where you started. So there's always a loss factor. So it's kind of like a law of diminished returns. Dick, maybe you have a comment on that one. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
But you didn't take into consideration also the fact that when you have a magnetic cushion for the wagon on the track, then it's unexpected wind that could blow in the direction of the wagon. You don't pay for it, but you have extra energy. Now, if that energy is as strong as the Tacoma Bridge collapse causing the resonance, mechanical resonance, or is the smaller one that we don't know. So we may say that the extra energy could be higher than the losses or lower than the losses. And I'm trying to imply that the magnetic air may interact with the energy from surroundings. And to exist.
If I had a train that is magnetically suspended, and some of those trains, I believe, are using that phenomenon to go to 250 kilometers per hour, some of the European trains, the good news is you get a lot less friction out of a magnetic suspension, magnetic levitation. But you still got some eddy current losses. You also believe that there's ways of tapping into individual molecules and using the magnetic energy that's there. I'm a little worried that if you find a way of taking the magnetic energy out of a particular molecule, I'm a little bit afraid you're going to be collapsing that molecule. It's not the same anymore. You're converting it to something else. I'm a little worried now about whether or not we can find a free lunch here, if you know what I mean. Yes, if the wind was blowing your railroad car and you got the right kind of a sail on it, the wind blowing a sailboat or a skate type thing that you know, these ice boats, the wind powering something is a very nice way of getting free energy. But that free energy came from the wind. The wind came from the sun shining on the earth and making thermals, you know. The air was rising in one place and sinking in another, and that's one of the mechanisms by which we get wind. Wind generators to generate electrical power for a community, or solar voltaic power. Both of these are really finding a way of tapping into the sun. It's really the solar energy that we're tapping. Let me drop. So when we're using wind power, when we're using solar voltaics, when we're using tide, when we're using tide is by way of the moon, but when we're using waterfall, you know, the Niagara type fall, almost all of that is coming from the sun. And when it comes to the petroleum that we burn, you're really burning a past solar event. Those hydrocarbons are plants that once lived and eventually became a petroleum product after a long number of years. So we're really burning past solar events when we're burning a petroleum product. So as I see it, the real source of energy, the horse's mouth, is the sun. Everything else is indirect. But maybe I'm being overly simplistic. KQRIW listening.
Well, Dick, I'm talking about free energy as a factor of lunch that your friend paid for it. I'm not talking about free energy that comes from nothing, because this is nonsense. What I'm talking is you getting married and getting help from your wife, and you don't have to pay for it, although it's not always true. And to exchange.
I once saw a joke where a person was asking the question, what is the most expensive meal you have ever had? And the answer that the guy said was wedding cake.
Now, talking about Eddie's current lens level. The core is wrapped over the capacitor. So let's say we take a 1500 microfarad, 200 volt capacitor, 3-inch diameter, 4-inch high. And with one single strand, let's say we use 10 AWG wire, the thickness of the wire. And it's coated. And let's say we put 25 turns of the around the capacitor.
Describe the capacitor completely, Wesley.
Yeah, is it a electrolytic capacitor, a polarized capacitor, or a non-polarized capacitor? Makes a big difference.
Thank you, Dick, and thank you, John. I'm going to go into that. I pulse the coil with my Hewlett-Packard frequency generator at 16 volts at milliamps, let's say the 15.2 megahertz, and there is definitive coupling being inferred to the capacitor that lights up, let's say, 5 volt DC LED spark. A geotank capacitor holds 5.36 volts. And if we do more tests, we put in the capacitor in vertical to see any difference in the way of imagining, let's say we try to do certain things, and it did not show any major changes in coupling. But I think that the best could be to use it as a step-down transformer if the coils were being pulsed with a high voltage. Now, about 3-4 weeks ago, I have noticed that these coils could be wrapped over the capacitors. And I tried, but the cap was non-polarized. It was black plastic case capacitor. And I didn't see noticeable effect. But the DC capacitor is different. And I'm actually stunned that I'm getting coupling like I would get with so many of my coils to coil systems. The best part of it... The best part of it is that I'm going to risk that somebody's going to laugh. There should be no Lenz law involved in such coils to the capacitor transfers. And I'm sure that at higher voltages, the transfer will be rather generous. And that I'm thinking that the devices that I saw that are questionable, Tario Campanazzo SR, use this kind of draw of power back to the system. The coils are being rather thick wire wound and offer next to no resistance to the pulse feed line. Another laugh from you guys. While the energy is being pulled through the coils, the capacitor draw off some return power without creating any major added resistance to the feed line. This is rather major thing here that just opened some of the new, I believe, avenues for playing ground. Just the new way worth to hustle of discovery and to exam.
Information for you, Dick.
Yeah, go ahead, John.
The capacitor he's using is a polarized DC cap with an isolated can. It has the two screw terminals on top. The can is not connected to either the negative or positive side, just so you have a full description of the can.
And it looks like a Faraday cage that it is open, not necessarily, from one side where you have the plus and minus.
At first it sounded like you've got these 15 turns of 10-gauge wire or whatever it was with coil. I had the impression that you had that coil in series with the capacitor, you put it onto your instrumentation, and you measured a resonant frequency. And by the way, with many microfarads, I'm having trouble believing that that was an HF frequency of resonance, because most HF generators take, you know, some number of picofarads, not microfarads. But I'll let that one go by.
Well, guess what? I spoke about it with Eric. I used another capacitor, 5,800 microfarads. And I put the coil on it around 40 winds on it. And I delivered 30 millivolts. In one instance, by driving of generator, I was getting, of course, the current was not measured, over 1 volt.
A full description yet, Dick.
Was 3.5 megahertz, and another frequency response was 8.3, I believe, megahertz.
I had two of those capacitors, Dick, WS2N.
Go ahead with the fuller description there, John.
He wound a solenoid coil on the metal body of the cap, not connected to the two screws. And he is inducing a current in that coil, and he's getting the effect out of the two screws, such as an LED or something like that. That's what he's doing. It's not connected to the actual capacitor.
Thank you for visiting the Amateur Radio Club repeater system.
It's an AC electrolytic capacitor, if I understand correctly, or a non-polarized capacitor.
No, it's DC. At this point, it's DC 5,800 microfarads capacitor, 40 winds of a gauge 14 wire.
KC2, QAQ with a clarification.
Go ahead, Clint.
Wesley, let me describe this to see if I'm getting the picture that you're explaining. In other words, right now you have a coil of wire, and you've got a aluminum electrolytic capacitor, you know, plus minus on the two top pins. So this is a big aluminum electrolytic cap. And it sounds like on the terminals of the aluminum electrolytic cap, you're connecting some LEDs. That's what it sounds like. And then you've got a isolated coil wrapped around the body of the this cylindrical aluminum electrolytic capacitor that you're connecting up to a signal generator. And you're putting in something, some frequency and some current or some energy into that coil. And what you're saying is that you're getting a voltage generated across the capacitor. Is that what you, to light the LED? Is this what you're saying?
That is very much correct. I was using this in different configuration, I have also been using George Packard gain phase analyzer in impedance mode, which would